Welcome back to the Rambling Geek and to our first episode of 2021. We are recording this on January 7th, so that's January 6th in America. And today a lot of serious stuff has been going down in America, specifically in Washington. We are but humble entertainers here to hopefully give you an hour or so of reprieve from the world. And while we won't talk politics on the show, we wanted to take a minute to say we hope all our American friends stay safe in these turbulent times, wherever you are. With that said, let's get rambling.
Hold on to your butts.
Let's get ready to
ramble.
Happy New Year to you out there listening in podcast land, and welcome to episode 4. I am Mike, and with me as always is my trusty co-host, Brian.
Hello.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Did you get some time to get some geek in over the Christmas and New Year break?
I did get some geek in. I've been playing some old games.
Oh, nice. What have you been playing?
A little bit of retro gaming. I've gone back to, yet again, Batman Arkham City. It's the Return to Arkham series that I've been playing.
Nice.
And so working my way through a bit of that. So it was nice to beat up the Penguin and go one-to-one with Solomon Grundy and all of that. That's still a very cool game, one of my favorites. And I went even further back onto the PS, that was on PS4, and even further back onto the PS3, and I've been playing God of War 2.
Ooh.
Yeah, one level or one trophy away from getting the platinum on that. A lot of people are probably thinking, yeah, I got that.
When I was 15.
Platinums are rare. Yeah, for me. Yeah, so that's what I've been doing. And, of course, I watched Wonder Woman 84.
Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that. It might get a bit contentious on the show, from the little we have.
It might.
We've tried to stay away from discussing it in depth between the two of us because we knew we wanted to talk about it on the show, but we have skirted some conversation, I guess, and we sort of know where each other stands, but yeah, we'll get on to that.
And that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. We're still friends. Cool. All right. Yeah, what have I been doing? I have been playing some older games. I like how you say that a PS4 game is now a retro game. PS5 just came out, man.
It
shows
how
long PS4
is. 2021. Been. Come on. New gen.
Yeah,
true. Next gen console.
Well, when they come back in stock.
Yeah, that too. I went looking and don't know about the rest of the world where people are listening, but you cannot get them here.
No, I think it's like the PS4. It's better to wait a year, I feel. Like, let them build up a library of solid games.
Mm-hmm.
Get all the glitches out of the system.
Yep.
And
patch away.
And there'll certainly be a slimline version or something. Because, I mean, look at that thing. So we'll just hold our horses for a little bit. But, yeah, I had to go back to PS3 because my PS4 decided it was no longer wanting to live and won't power on or anything. I don't know what's wrong with it. So if I wanted to game, I had to step back a bit. And I've been playing Disney Universe, which is super fun because my four-year-old is now, I'm sort of getting her into the gaming space. So she had the PS4 going. She was playing Paw Patrol. It's a nice, easy side scroller for her to learn. Then she jumped over to Spyro, the remastered trilogy, which is a big step up because you have to have camera control and all of that. So you have to use two joysticks. She's only got little hands, but she's picking it up pretty well. And so I thought, well, if we step back to PS3, there might be some more kid-friendly games, because it is one thing PS4 lacks quite a bit of, outside of things like Lego, and only recently Crash and Spyro came back. But yeah, so I've been doing a bit of that. I was going to crank up the old original Red Dead Redemption, because I still love that game, and also the first of the Tomb Raider remakes, which is one of my all-time favorites.
Me too.
But then our good friend Darren came to the rescue when we met up on New Year's Day for a coffee, the three of us, and he sold me his PlayStation 4. So I am, as of now, back to, well, can't even say modern gaming now.
No.
More recent gaming. So that'll be my weekend, I think. So.
Nice. I was thinking, over time we could track this, and then your daughter can help us to answer the question, are geeks born or made?
True. Well, she's learned a lot of stuff through osmosis, I think.
Yep, that was always going to be the case. We always knew that.
Your kids. She's picked up things by herself, though. Like I used to teach her names because I've got a lot of action figures and things lying around. And she learned things like Captain America, definitely Wonder Woman because favorite, and a few others. But, you know, one day she came up to me. I think I turned Justice League or Justice League Unlimited, something on the TV. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was even Justice League Action. And the heroes flashed up in the title cards. And she turns to me and says, "Where's the Flash?"
Oh.
I was like, "I didn't teach you who the Flash was."
Oh, that's a proud moment. Yeah, why is the Flash there?
Jeepers. So, yeah, she's learning this stuff. She knows most of the superheroes. And she asks if certain other characters are superheroes or not. So she's getting there. And I will mold her. Her and the other two.
They have no choice, but that's okay.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Yeah, I watched a few things. I finally got around to watching The Queen's Gambit, like Dean recommended in the last episode.
Yes, indeed.
And that is no surprise to anybody who's watched it. Fantastic. That is such a good show. You know, there's this meme, I guess is the best word for it, that goes around social media every so often, and it's describe a movie in the most boring way possible.
Okay.
And I feel like with The Queen's Gambit, when you explain it legitimately, it is the most boring way possible.
Right.
Because basically it is orphan girl learns chess, turns out she's a prodigy, and you follow her chess career. That sounds hideously boring.
Like okay. Six episodes out of that?
And you get seven, I think.
Is it seven? Okay. That's me being ironic, by the way. I'm aware that everybody says it's amazing. It's on my watch list. So.
Yeah, but that is the legitimate question. Like, how do you drag that? Is it going to be another overstuffed Netflix TV show? Hello, yeah. Defenders.
Wouldn't be the first.
Hello, all the Marvel, except for Daredevil, which was awesome. It is fantastic. Anya Taylor-Joy is just so good in the show. She's great to watch. She's, yeah, you just want to watch more of her. She plays the character fantastically. The supporting cast is all good. It's just a really, really good show. It's really well written. Like Dean said on the last episode, whoever the crew is that came together to make the show have poured so much love into making it feel like it really is set in the 60s. It's the fashion, the cinematography, the locations, everything. It's just really well done. And the cool thing is, as much as you want more because you just want to watch Anya Taylor-Joy more, it's a good thing that it's just a limited series. There's no need to make any more.
Yeah.
It's a one and done, hopefully.
Sometimes you got to know when to stop. I mean, and to your point around, you know, the look of it, I think that's pretty much where we're at these days. We talked about this a little on our Heritage Film Club podcast around The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
And it's the... as much of it as the visuals, you know, how it looks like the time period that it's meant to be in. And I think we're really at a stage now, which is great, that you can't cheap out on that anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
I think you really have to commit to it and say, well, if we're going to do 50s or 60s or 80s for Wonder Woman, you know, or anything, you really have to, it's all in the design because you can't just have it as window dressing. It really becomes part of the whole thing. And I think that's a really good space to be in. Movies and TV especially, it's really, I'm really picking that up now.
Yeah, but when you look at The Shape of Water and you're like, okay, that had tens of millions of dollars to play around with. And I don't know the budget of The Queen's Gambit, but it's TV. And even if it's Netflix, you know, it's not going to have a budget of like $90 million or something.
No, I mean, budgets are bigger than they used to be, but I take your point, yeah.
Yeah, but the fact that they can pull off something that looks movie quality, and this is not the only TV show that does it. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
I'm just saying on behalf of this show, because that's what we're talking about, it's... Yep. Movie quality. I mean, she's a movie actress anyway.
She is, yeah.
And she's going to be huge. I'd be surprised if she's not at least nominated for an Emmy for this. I'd be shocked if she wasn't nominated. I'd be surprised if she didn't win. She is just really good in this show. I just don't have the words. It's just very good.
Well, TV's the place to be now, right? It used to be that, you know, you were a movie actor and you wouldn't go back and do TV. It was, you'd moved beyond it. And now it's completely the other way around, I think, or it's they're kind of on a level plane. You know, people, big names come back and do TV, and it's good TV.
Yeah, and I wonder where that started. Would it be 24? Because I feel like Kiefer Sutherland coming and doing 24, which ended up being a huge deal.
Maybe something like that. I mean, you've got things like The West Wing, where you've got, you know, the actors are in The West Wing. Martin Sheen. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, there's probably a lot of things that you could point to that got the ball rolling a little.
Yeah, I guess HBO was. Yeah.
Mm. Once the money comes into it, and you've got Netflix in the game, and HBO, as you say, and all of that, it's I don't know, legitimizes. It's probably not the right word, but it's changed, and that's a good thing, because we're getting some really great TV. If we can we even call it TV? Streaming services, does that still count as television?
Oh, I watch it on my TV, but
where is that?
Well, that would mean Wonder Woman 84 is a TV show then, by that logic. I think OG HBO, the real HBO before what we have now, and Showtime and those cable channels pre-streaming, I guess, were really what legitimized TV and brought it into this sort of golden era of drama television and must-watch TV.
Yeah. You've got, I guess, people in Hollywood looking at The Sopranos and saying, this is better TV than movies we're making. Maybe that's what they're saying. And that kind of stuff helps.
Yeah, and now we're getting
quality. So.
And now we're getting a Sopranos sequel this year.
Really?
A movie, yeah. Prequel. Did I say prequel? Yeah.
Right. I was going to say, it's not something you should continue.
No, not with how they ended it.
Not how they ended it. No, you do a bit of Call Saul with it and go back, then great.
Yeah, that's the only way you can do it if you can't have James Gandolfini.
Indeed. And
you don't.
Or you definitely don't recast.
No. So,
nope.
No. Someone who might have been good as the Kingpin also.
Mm.
Anyway. Cool. So, yeah, I watched Queen's Gambit, and it was awesome. So if you haven't watched it yet because you think it's a boring chess TV show, it's not. It is about chess, but it's about a lot more as well. It's her life and her navigating it, and that probably makes it sound even more boring, but it's not. It's a really good show. I think because it's based on a novel, I feel like I'd really struggle reading the novel because I feel like, depending on how close the TV show is to the book, it would be very heavy with chess lingo, I imagine. And that's all right in a TV show because even if you don't know chess, which I don't, you can follow along because you're watching stuff on the screen and it's not imperative that you know this stuff. No. But when you're reading a book and it's probably going and explaining all these chess moves, not being able to visualize it might make it really tricky.
Yeah, difficult thing to write, I would imagine. Maybe it's the quality of the writer just to give the tension explaining chess moves.
Yeah, or maybe they don't go into it as much as on the show. I don't know.
Maybe not. But, yeah, it would be interesting just to do a comparison, I guess, and see what you get.
Yeah. But anyway, highly recommend. And apart from Wonder Woman, have you watched anything else?
I sat down and rewatched Blade Runner 2049 the other night.
Oh.
Just because it felt like it. Have you not seen it?
I haven't even seen the original.
Oh.
Well, none of the 32 versions of the original.
Well, yeah, it is a case of, the choose your own adventure version of Blade Runner. Yeah, pick whichever one of Ridley's versions he likes. I like the second one better than the first one, if I'm honest with you.
You mean the sequel movie?
I like 2049 better than the original Blade Runner.
Okay.
I've been in the vast minority, I think, ever since it came out, Blade Runner, of people who think it's an overrated movie. And listening to Ridley Scott make lots of pronouncements over time and saying, yes, Deckard is a replicant, this, that, and the other, because I think, as if it was an idea that he had right from the start, and I don't believe it for a moment. You know, I think it's just something that he's picked up on over time.
Fan theories,
yeah, and gone, oh, yes, that was always the case, and me, I don't buy it. It's a good movie. It's well worth watching. I really enjoyed 2049. I'm a big fan of the director of the new one anyway, so I figured I was going to like it. It looks fantastic. I think it's great acting in it. It's a great science fiction movie, and that's not something you can say a lot of the time. And so I watched that, and that was, probably about the other pop culture-ish thing, geekiest thing, I suppose, that I've done while I've been on my break at the moment, other than watching the elephant in the room, Wonder Woman 84.
Yeah, we'll get there very shortly. So, and with the Blade Runner, so if I was wanting to go back and watch the original Blade Runner, which is the version I'm supposed to watch, this is one of the things that has made me...
Genuinely, who knows? If you watch the final cut, you can watch the original one. For mine, I don't really think it makes a great deal of difference. You get the story, you get the characters. Whatever you can find, watch that.
Okay, so maybe we should throw this out to you guys who are listening. Any fans of Blade Runner, which I assume there are more than a few, recommend or tell me on social media at TRG Podcast or on Twitter at The Rambling Geek which version of the original Blade Runner I should watch, because that really has been what's blocking me from bothering. Because I just don't know. Like, does it make a difference? Is there should I just watch the original one because that's what everyone saw and loved?
I genuinely think for mine that you just watch whatever one is available. The first one you find, watch that because you get the whole thing. I think a lot of it's, people may have a different opinion. I think a lot of it is just fiddling.
Usually is with those sort of things.
Yeah, those, you know, we've added 5 minutes here or we've cut this out or we put something slightly different or the mild bits about the ending. I think in the end, you'll get Blade Runner.
Yeah, I feel like there was just this wave of that fiddling stuff, man. Like there was Blade Runner, there was Star Wars, the original trilogy, there was E.T. It's like, man, we already loved the movie.
Yeah, just let it be. I mean, I don't mind the director's cut. If you want to put something, you know, in general, if you want to go and put 15 minutes back in that you really wanted in, but the studio made you take out, or whatever. You know, if you've got a director's cut and that was the version that you wanted, do that. I don't see that there's really a need to go and do it six times.
Yeah, and this might be a contentious point to some listeners, but my problem with, actually, no, I think people will agree with me. My problem with George Lucas doing his special editions of the original trilogy was that he wasn't doing that. He was, I wish I'd had CGI, so now I'm going to add some CGI in.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, and I'm going to make Jabba the Hutt the slug guy instead of what he was in that first movie, which no one had a problem with. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's going back. And the problem with those, the biggest problem that I have with those is that you can see the wires. You know, the things that he put in and made different, they stand out
so much.
And for mine, it really takes you it takes you out of the movie.
Yeah, and that was the same with E.T. as well.
Yeah, and it sort of detracts from the original point. Just let it be what it was. You know, it's out there. People loved it.
Yeah.
It ain't broke.
Exactly. And I think I mentioned this to you before, but imagine if Spielberg went back now and did that to Jaws. I'm going to CGI the shark.
Oh, no.
You know, it's like, no.
Hollywood blasphemy, things you don't do.
Yeah, I mean, that shark has its own whole history. You can't just go and erase it for something that will end up looking like 47 meters below.
Yeah, you put the shark from the shallows into Jaws, and then, you break it is what you do if you change it. Yeah.
You know, don't break it. That Shallows movie, and this still skirts the realms of geek because it's got Blake Lively and she's married to Deadpool and she was Carol Ferris, for better or worse, in the Green Lantern movie. But that Shallows movie is fantastic. I love it.
It is, completely.
Until they show the shark.
No, I'm done. I'm done all the way. I'm invested.
Statue. That shark was ridiculous.
No, like, I'm good there.
I don't hate the movie for it. Scary shark. Yeah, it is a scary shark. But why does it have to be so big? That's just a joke. Like, I don't know. Could have just been a normal great white. And that still would have been scary enough.
I think you don't get the ending out of the Shallows that you would have had if it was just a
true
normal size. What's a normal size shark? I don't know. Yeah. I loved it. I thought it was great for the movie. Yeah. It's a great ending. If you've not seen it, anybody who's not seen it, completely recommended. Go and watch the Shallows.
If you're a shark movie fan, then you've probably seen it. But if you haven't,
just
do it. It's really
go watch
good.
It now. When you finish listening to this, go and watch the Shallows.
Yeah, it's like Ryan Reynolds did his solo movie in Buried, and then his wife thought, I want a piece of that action, and went and made The Shallows, which predominantly stars just her, a Finn, and a seagull for a little bit.
And the seagull. And the seagull's terrific.
It's very enjoyable. All right, and before we go into Wonder Woman, I just will point out that I also watched Soul from Pixar, which also dropped on Christmas Day, or over here Boxing Day, because we're a day ahead. It was a movie.
Take from that review what you will.
You know what I think? I think Pixar is getting too smart for itself. I think, you know, when Pixar started and it was this untouchable production company, right, like Marvel is now, and they barely made a bomb, right, especially for the first good decade, probably. Every movie was either an Oscar winner or critically acclaimed or whatever. And the thing that was the most praised, I guess, was that they had something that was essentially a movie for kids, but had a lot of adult jokes. So parents would also find it enjoyable, right? And it was a great thing Pixar was able to do. They were very, very clever with the types of humor. It appealed to all ages, literally. It was a lot of
movies do that. A lot of movies around that time did the same thing, though. The Ice Age has some really cool stuff like that. Shrek.
Yeah, but that all came after.
You know, the original. No, what I mean though is that that was kind of the tone that was set though. You know, Shrek did that, and you've got the adults laughing at half of it and the kids laughing at the other half.
Yeah, but I would say still that this originated from Toy Story and.
Oh, you're not arguing the point. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, it was just the kind of the form that was set. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They set a tone and that became the thing, right? And that's a lot of times what animated movies are now critiqued on. So, you know, there's nothing in it for adults. You'll see in reviews for certain movies and things like this. What I feel now with Soul is that they've gone the complete opposite way and now are writing for adults. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, because you could argue that a lot of Studio Ghibli movies are more adult-focused.
Yeah, that's not comparing apples with apples, though, let's be honest.
No, it's not. But no. Pixar, who is a company who is built on being like a Disney, who is now a Disney, you know, family movies, kids movies, whatever you want to call them. Mm. Now, Soul is definitely not a kids movie. It is in no way that I can see aimed at children. I watched it by myself and thought, I can't sit my four-year-old in front of this and have her enjoy it. It's not that it's a bad movie. I'm just saying it's Pixar's sort of gone like, oh, we can make adults laugh. Let's just do that, is almost what it feels like. You know, you had Up, and one of the big achievements critically with Up was that they managed to make a movie that made a lot of money and a lot of kids liked that was about an old man, right?
Mm, yeah.
And then they made Inside Out, which is a super complex theme for a kids movie.
Yeah.
But a super enjoyable one that kids can still relate to through the characters. Soul is an even deeper sort of theme about what happens after you die and things like that. You know, finding your purpose in life, which is a good theme for a movie. But the main character is a, I don't know how old he's supposed to be, but 30s or 40s probably. I don't know, probably getting that wrong. Somebody will tell me off online. Who is a high school or middle school music teacher who wants to be a jazz player, a jazz pianist, and gets his shot and then dies and then spends the movie trying to get back in time to still get a shot because he's died too early and didn't get to fulfill his reason for living, I guess.
Potential.
Yeah, it didn't get to fulfill his potential. And yes, they introduced the character of 22, who's a soul who's so anti going to Earth. She skirts her training, so she can't get sent to Earth to become whoever she's going to become. And that's Tina Fey, and that's she's fun and everything, but still that's not enough for a kid to latch onto, I feel. But anyway, I'm sounding really down about it. It's a good movie. It's technically a very good movie in terms of the CGI and just the rendering of things like the saxophones. And, you know, Pixar is a company who has gone from having to make Toy Story because they needed something that had a shiny texture, so toys, and then building and improving their technology themselves to be able to accommodate growth in their movies. Now they've got to a point where they're just spot on. These are beautiful movies. But, yeah, I just feel like they missed their target audience with this one. Maybe that's a shift they're trying to make. Maybe they're trying to make more adult fare, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you're a company who's built on kids. Maybe it's kids who have grown up with these movies, like, you know, like me. I was 15, I think, when Toy Story came out, and I've grown up with these movies, and so now I can look at a movie with an adult theme and take it for what it is. But I just feel it's not a movie you could then sit down with your kids and go, check out this cool animated movie, because it just won't hold their interest.
I don't think there's anything wrong with making that kind of movie and pitching to a different audience. What I do think, and again, having not seen it, I think that you have to be quite clear as a company, though, what your movie's about and who you're pitching it at.
Yeah.
So you want to be clear that it's not one that you would sit down with your four-year-old and watch this movie. Or maybe you would, and she would just enjoy it for the visuals, and she's not going to pick up all the subtleties of the dialogue, and that's fine. You know, there's room for movies around for that kind of audience. So I think you just need to be really clear when you're producing it and putting it out there to go, that's what this is about. Here's who it's recommended for. Go watch it.
That was not a criticism of the dialogue and things going over the kids' heads. It was more visually there's not that sort of fun-looking character for a lot of the movie that the kid would latch onto. There's a bit of slapstick. Again, the character of 22 is fun, but the majority of the movie is following a middle-aged guy who wants to play jazz.
Right.
And I feel like even if it's visually stunning, which it is, it's not going to be enough to hold my kid's attention. Maybe I should get her to watch it and just see how long she lasts.
Maybe you could test the theory, yeah.
Yeah, test the theory, yeah. Mm. But and to your point of making these movies and pitching them in advance, so you know who you're targeting, you can't do that if the name Pixar is on it. Pixar is a brand that comes with expectations, you know, like Disney.
So do you think they need kind of an arm, like in comic books, at least a while back, you would have gone with Vertigo as opposed to normal DC, for example. And then that creates an expectation as well that when you're getting a book which is branded Vertigo, you're getting this. And it's not, you know, Teen Titans from the cartoon.
Yeah, it would have to be. I don't know how you do it because you can't just slap a Disney label on it because that's obviously a very well-established brand with a target audience. Pixar is the same. Yeah, it would almost have to be a whole different, like you say, a whole different studio name maybe.
Yeah, it's like I'm not sure what the film version of a different imprint is, but maybe it's something like that. I mean, there's things on Disney Plus. We look at some of those movies and say, well, John Carter, for example, a movie I really like, but same. Some of that is not entirely, I wouldn't say it's not kid-friendly, but it's not pitched at kids for a lot of it. It's a really good adventure story, but there's some interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, and again, I don't have any problem with it not being pitched at kids. I have more of a problem that it's a Pixar movie that is not aimed or doesn't have a lot to offer kids, in my opinion. But anyway, there's probably going to be a lot of angry people.
We're saying use the phrase a Pixar movie, and that's not just the... That's not just a phrase that says it was made by Pixar. I think it's kind of set an expectation. I think is what you're saying. And yeah, it's an area of film where you hear Pixar and immediately in your head you've got an audience that you think you're going to assume it's being targeted at or made for.
Yeah.
And then when it breaks that kind of expectation, like this obviously has done with you, it throws you.
Yeah, that's the good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's probably what it was. It threw me. I mean, the trailer didn't try and hide any of this, to be fair, but... Yeah, I think you probably still, after watching a two-minute trailer, go in going, oh, there's going to be a lot of that 22 character or, you know, something to hook that audience. But, yeah, maybe that's a good way of saying it. It threw me because it was against expectations. And that's not a bad thing. And it's not a bad movie. It's just I think I need to rewatch it through the lens of knowing what it is and see how I come away from it.
Well, I'll have to watch it myself and having heard your perspective on it. Because I would have gone in with the same expectation that you had.
Yeah, but see, now I've ruined that, so you'll go in differently.
I'm keen to look at it now with a different expectation set and see what I make of it.
Okay, so we can come back and talk about that on another episode. So there you go. Something to look forward to, and I'll wait for all the bashing I get on social media now for saying what I said about Soul.
It's all opinion, people.
It's all opinion, and everyone's entitled to it, but... we're deciding to broadcast ours, so we get what we get.
I need to bear that in mind every time you and I talk about something that we disagree on.
Which is it's coming up now. Yeah. So I'd give Soul probably a solid 3 out of 5. It's still a very nice looking movie. I like how they handled the theme. And I think it just threw me. So and that's really what it was. So thanks for explaining how I felt better than I could. And I don't say that sarcastically. I mean it.
It's why I'm here.
Yeah. Right, should we do it? Should we talk about Wonder Woman?
Let's.
My life hasn't been what you probably think it has. We all have our struggles.
Have you ever been in love?
A long, long time ago. You?
So many times, yeah. All the time.
Welcome to the future. Life is good, but it can be better.
And why shouldn't it be? All you need is to want it.
Right. Do you want to go first? Because I'm going to be way more positive about it than I expect you're going to be.
I'm going to flip that back to you. I'm keen to understand why you liked it. Okay. Why you liked it as much as you did. I'm not saying that I hated it. I was disappointed in it. I think it's how I explained it to you when we were talking about it before. I found it a disappointing movie, Wonder Woman 84.
Okay. But I'll have to bring up some of my points that I didn't like as well.
which is
it's not a perfect movie by any stretch. Okay, so Wonder Woman, the first one from 2017, is a great movie.
Excellent movie. Yeah, enjoyed it very much.
It's the first Avenger, but with Wonder Woman. It has a poor third act, but it is still head and shoulders above any of the other DCEU movies to that point, in my opinion. Man of Steel bugged me too much with certain choices they made in that movie. Batman vs. Superman, yep, that's a movie.
Yep.
Justice League is horrendous. It is terrible. Wonder Woman debuted in Batman vs. Superman and was the shining light for 5 minutes in that movie.
She was the good bit, yes.
She was the good bit. And I'm not just saying that as a biased fan because I love Wonder Woman. I think most people can agree that that was a very strong part of that movie. Wonder Woman, the movie, was great. My problems with the original was I hated the Amazonian versus Germans battle on Themyscira because of how overly CGI or wire tricked it was. It just, the physics were all out, and it just, I know they're supposed to be these super Amazonian warriors and stuff, but there's still physics, right? And it's a big problem in the sequel too.
And I didn't enjoy the fact that apparently you can just sail to the island. That was never the point. Even if you don't know where it is, you can kind of stumble upon it, which just seems stupid to me. But anyway, beyond that.
Yeah, but that would be the thing. It's only cloaked, right? So if someone did stumble upon it, they can stumble upon it, right?
Yeah, I guess that. I mean, even originally, I think that's how Steve Trevor gets there. It just seems like a weird thing to do. It's like, you know, if eventually someone's going to sail into the island, let's be honest. It just seems like it's not a great piece of cloaking if all you need to do is to be sailing in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually have a problem with that in the first movie because I thought it looked cool that, you know, his plane came down and then the ship comes through the bubble or whatever.
Yeah, out of the fog and into the sunshine, which is a pretty cool visual, yeah.
Yeah, and I just feel that the overly CGI'd super heroics, for lack of a better word, just was off-putting. Mm. And the third act was flat. It was just, I don't know if I like movies that swerve on the villain. Like, this is my problem with Luke Cage, the TV series. You invest in a villain and then they swerve you. And then I just sort of don't care because I was already invested in the first villain. Not that it was a strong villain anyway. But we've talked about this before. If you're going to have the first Wonder Woman movie and you're going to make the villain Ares, you've just shot your load, for lack of a better term, because
you've gone big. Yeah.
Yeah, you've gone too big.
You went too big too soon.
Yes. Yeah, and I know they built it in from the start, saying Ares got expelled by Zeus and all of that, but you could still build up to it in the background, like Thanos in the MCU. And
Or you go too big too early, and then you've got Lex Luthor problems in that you can't think of anywhere else to go, so you just go Ares again.
Yeah,
so you either dial back, or you go back to the same one again and again, which is just boring.
And the problem with Wonder Woman is she doesn't have a deep enough rogues gallery that you have a lot of other choices anyway if you use all your big guns right out the gate.
True.
So even though Batman will always fall back on a Joker or some such, he has got the opportunity to go with a Catwoman or Mr. Freeze or whatever. Yeah.
Correct, yeah.
So anyway, overall, loved Wonder Woman, the first one. So I was very excited to go into this. One, because it's a sequel to Wonder Woman, but two, because it's supposed to be set in the 80s. And I'm a sucker for the 80s. I love it. However, I feel like I'll go back to the Amazonian scene that it opens within a minute, but I feel like they crammed all of the 80s stuff into the first 5 minutes plus the mall scene and then forgot it was supposed to be set in the 80s, other than from the wardrobe department.
Yeah, well, the bit where Steve Trevor's dressing and they're trying to figure out what he's going to wear, and that's the thing that's going to beat you over the head to say, hey, remember, this is in the 80s.
Yeah, but that's a nice 80s movie montage type of throwback, which I appreciated.
Yeah, it was a little obvious, if I'm honest with you. It's a little bit it was just a big neon sign, probably right for the 80s, that says, we're in the 80s. And then that was out of the way, and then they got on with the rest of the action, and that was what it was.
Because honestly, outside of the mall scene, and the couple of minutes before the mall scene, so the car with the jocks in it that's speeding around the road and almost runs over the spandex-clad jogger, which is like, here's all the 80s stuff we're going to throw in all at once. Then it sort of forgets. Like when she eventually goes over to the Middle East, you'd be forgiven for not thinking that's set in the 80s at all. I mean, that's, I guess you could argue that even if you went to the Middle East now, and this is hopefully not going to come across as a racist comment because it's not, but, you know, it's still reminiscent of its past, right? So it's still got old buildings, older ways of dressing for the most part. Not all of it, obviously. So I guess you can forgive that in the movie. I just feel like, yeah, they sort of, it wasn't full of, it didn't have a big 80s soundtrack. You know, it could have Suicide Squad, or better example, could have Guardians of the Galaxy'd it. Mm-hmm. And put a superb 80s soundtrack in. I mean, Warner Brothers has got the money and they probably own most of the bloody music as it is. So, yeah, that was a bit of a letdown, the lack of 80s in a movie called Wonder Woman 1984. The very opening where it's, you know, the titles are coming up on the screen, the cast is coming up on the screen, it's panning over these mountains on Themyscira to get to the Colosseum. And it's got this really nice Hans Zimmer upbeat score, and it comes up with, directed by Patty Jenkins and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, this feels real triumphant. Like, you just pulled off the best DCEU movie, and now you're coming back strong, you know, with probably a lot more money, an established character that everyone loves. Yeah, this is really good. This is good energy. It feels like it's sort of your triumphant entrance into the sequel. And then it gets to the Colosseum, and I'm like, okay, cool. So this is sort of like the Amazon Games or the Olympics or something. But there's about 15 different events going on at once. And straight away goes on to that whole physics problem again, where Amazonians can just sort of float up. They don't have to sort of spring. Mm-hmm. They can run up more. I mean, I guess, yeah, you're supposed to be building this mythology around how awesome the Amazonians are. But just put some physics in it, man. Like, make it look look like they've jumped that high, you know? Yeah. And this is a problem in the mall scene as well, when Wonder Woman is flying around on her lasso that has no rules in terms of it's as long as she needs it to be. I guess it's supposed to be lifting her up, sort of like Spider-Man's web would drag him along. Yeah, she just seems to float. And this is before she learns to fly. Spoiler. Obviously, there's going to be spoilers in this. We're going to be spoiler heavy. I should have said that at the beginning. But
here we are.
I don't know. Like, I love Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman and Diana Prince. I think she's great casting. The casting over this whole movie, I didn't have a problem with. I loved Kristen Wiig as Barbara Minerva right up until when she becomes Cheetah properly. Mm-hmm. So basically, when they got to the White House, how she looks there, that's, in my opinion, where they should have stopped. If they were going to go full Cheetah, at least shave off her hair, the hair on top, her human hair on top of her head, because it just looks stupid. Commit. If you're going to commit, just do it. Yeah.
She's Cheetah for about 5 minutes. And it almost, in hindsight, I could almost say it's like they had 5 minutes worth of CGI budget for her, so they make her Cheetah for 5 minutes.
And that's probably true, because they also did it in the dark.
Yeah, maybe that's the thing, and it's kind of, and she's not even there long enough to be scary. No, she's much more intimidating as a human Cheetah.
Yeah, that White House scene.
Yeah, she's way more menacing.
Yep.
And apart from the fact that Wonder Woman is kind of depowered a little bit by that point, you know, and she's genuinely in danger. You don't feel, once she turns up, she's in the armor and she's fighting Cheetah in largely the dark. It doesn't feel like she's in danger.
Yeah, it's the same as the first movie. The third act falls really flat. So I'll give some positives, because I do actually like this movie. I'm not someone who's hating on it to the extent of a lot of people
guilty
on social media, right?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's all opinion.
I think it's a fine movie. It's a good sequel, but it's not a sequel that even holds a candle to the original. It's fine. It's still better than most of the other DCEU stuff. I'm going to say that. And I don't care what you say to us afterwards. I'm sticking with my opinion. The casting is great. Pedro Pascal is awesome. He chews the scenery so much, and he plays the character they've written very well. They've written Maxwell Lord in this movie as an infomercial salesman, and that's exactly how he plays it. And it's fun to watch. It's very, very over the top. As I said, Kristen Wiig is great. She plays the stereotypical trope character of the nerdy person that everyone ignores, who then somehow gets her powers and becomes the stronger character. And for some reason, that means she has to turn evil. But she is very good as the, as you said, as the menacing Barbara, because I don't want to call her Cheetah because she wasn't Cheetah yet. And I love Chris Pine in these movies. I'm not like a huge fan of him in general, but I feel like Wonder Woman 1 picked up heaps when Steve Trevor and Wonder Woman started sharing scenes together. And he is obviously the humor of the movie both times. And I feel like when he came back, regardless of how he came back, I'm not a big fan of that, but he still injected the humor. And those two have very good chemistry together, in my opinion. I'm just going to say in my opinion a lot because that's what it is. Yeah, and the Quantum Leap thing, man, that's really pushing the 80s references because that'll be over heaps of people's heads. But basically, that's what it was. Steve Trevor quantum leaped into random dude's body, and that guy got to be Dinah's boyfriend without knowing it, Wonder Woman's boyfriend without knowing it, in body only. And that raises a whole lot of other weird questions as well. But I'm trying to think of what my positives were now, and because I do have some, and I didn't come out of the movie disappointed, just that the third act was weak. And I did love the end credit or mid credit scene. I cheered because I was just fanboying with that. And spoiler, the mid credit scene being Linda Carter popping up. And for me, that was just like a very cool moment. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like, and you're going to disagree with this heavily, I imagine, that maybe specifically in this, I'm going to call it Snyderverse, they know Wonder Woman's character in this universe and what she stands for, even if it's on the nose, very on the nose. And she's sort of a hero, more so than Superman, I think, even in the DCEU, like a beacon of hope sort of hero. Anyway, you go, and I'm sure to think of more things about it.
I'll give you my 5-minute rundown of my take on this, and that's pretty much all I've got. Is it? I think I pretty much disagree with pretty much all of the reasons that you like this movie. And just because this was my take on it, for mine, I think it's an extremely disappointing movie, because I think they made, there are lots of choices that they could have made. And I think they had 75 plus years. Actually, what is it? It's 80 years now of Wonder Woman history that they could have mined. And they went down the road that they did. Whether it was they decided they were going to make it a 1984 movie and worked it backwards, or decided the story that they had and they wanted to set it in 1984, don't know, don't care. I thought it was an obvious movie. I don't think there's anything in there that I didn't see coming. I'll be honest with you, even the mid-credit scene, it was, yeah, that'll be Linda Carter. And that just feels like a Marvel knockoff. It's like it's something that we have to do now. I think if you were going to cameo Linda Carter, you did it first movie, for whatever reason that you did it. There's Steve Trevor uses via the magic wishing stone. So that's a plot point that you want. He inhabits this other guy's body. Immediately, you know, Steve's not staying.
Yes.
He's not staying. He's done. There's no tension in that anymore.
Yeah, true.
It's, you know, you know the road that Barbara Minerva is going down to become Cheetah. It's just the whole thing. Yeah. It's just a very obvious movie. The only thing that took me a little by surprise, I don't think, was one thing that you didn't like, and I did, was when you find that she's got the lasso around Max Lord's leg and she's talking to the rest of the world and not to him. And that kind of took me by surprise. And I went, oh, okay. I thought that was kind of a cool idea.
Yeah.
Everything else is all just, it was very formula. That starts off with the games at the beginning. And it's a cool little scene. You know, I get what you're saying about the physics of it and how the Amazons move and the kind of superpowered in that respect. And she doesn't win. I'm looking at it going, she's not winning this competition. And then it becomes a very heavy-handed piece of dialogue that beats you over the head with what the theme of this movie is.
Yes.
And then they just keep beating you over the head with the theme of that movie right through the movie until it pays off and she has to make that decision. She makes that choice to renounce. And I'm sitting there looking at it going, where is the surprise? And it just makes – I felt like it made lazy choices. Steve has been dead since 1918, 14, something, somewhere in the First World War. He's back in the body of someone who does not know how to fly a plane.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about that.
Gets into a jet. and immediately is able to fly it. Diana then discovers that she has powers that allows her to make things invisible, which she does say she's been working on with a coffee cup. And then, well, there's your invisible plane. Tick. That's one off the bingo card. It's a cool way to do it. And don't get me wrong, if you're going to do an invisible plane, it makes more sense than we've got a scientist on Themyscira who not only developed a plane but made it invisible as well. Yep. So we get that. There's clunky stuff in there. And then I think Max Lord is just an underwhelming – I'm not even sure he counts as a villain, if I'm honest with you. You're right in that everybody who played what they were given to play played it really well.
Yep.
No issue with that. I thought he was really good. I just think it's a cop-out version of a big bad for that movie. And so it lost me. It was, wait, this is Max Lord? And admittedly, I have the 1987 Justice League in my head, which was the Bwahaha League, blue and gold. And there is a bit of that going, okay, you're not taking this seriously. And then I couldn't take it seriously either. And that just kind of, it set the tone for me as far as that went. Gal Gadot is fantastic. She is a terrific Wonder Woman. If anybody was ever going to come close to doing a Wonder Woman to approach Linda Carter's, who is still the peak, Gal Gadot, she's fantastic. And I like the way that they pitch her character. I like the way that they've done her here, absolutely. But yeah, beyond that, I'm at a point now where I look at it and go, if you made a third one, would I watch it? I genuinely don't know. I haven't watched Justice League or Aquaman because they burned me on Superman versus Batman, whichever way around that goes. I mean, going, you're quite right. Wonder Woman was the, not just the best thing in that movie, she was the good thing in that movie.
Yeah.
As done. And yeah, I think it was just, say, I had higher expectations going in from having seen Wonder Woman, which I genuinely liked for all the reasons that you said, and even, you know, weak third act and all that, as you say. Going in and thinking, this is what I've come in for, and I got none of it because I just thought it was an obvious movie.
Well, when you put it like that.
Yeah. This, again, it's just opinion. We look, there's things to like in that movie and things that I didn't, and they are what they are.
Yeah, I mean, it still doesn't compare to even most of the lower Marvel movies. We'll give it that. But, and this is not a Marvel versus DC conversation because no,
they shouldn't be. There are things you can learn from things that the other guys do well.
Yes, but nothing except wrong that with DC that. Doesn't seem to want to learn.
No, look, one tip of the hat I'll give to DC is that Wonder Woman is clearly a character that you had to do, but they did it. They did it, and you can go strong female lead, and frankly, potentially more powerful than Superman in this universe.
Yeah.
And it's you know, there's a good mythos behind it, and there are things that they could do, things they could go back to, and they did that. I just think they missed the mark here.
I almost want to see like another Wonder Woman movie with Gal Gadot, but with a different director and definitely a different writer, because I think part of the problem with the writing of this movie is it was Geoff Johns who was co-writing it.
I agree. My heart sank a little bit when I saw the opening credits and I saw written by, and there was a co-writer credit in there of Geoff Johns, and I did not feel good.
Yeah, we talked about that on the first episode when we were talking about Green Lantern. But, you know, he had a time where he was the guy, the writer for DC. And
for comics, absolutely.
For comics. And he wrote some really amazing stuff.
Completely.
And then he
ran out.
Yeah, and man, he milks Flashpoint. Any chance he gets. Man, it's not that good. There's plenty of all the Flashpoint spin-offs. One with Martha Wayne as the Joker or whatever it was.
Night of Vengeance and all of that. That's just some terrific stuff in there. And he had an absolute golden run. Yeah. He had a sweet spot of stuff that he wrote in the comics. But yeah, there's a point at which anything that he's touching for mine now, I can't buy into.
Yeah, and I think it would have been better to get Alan Heinberg back, who co-wrote the first one. I don't know enough about Patty Jenkins to know if she's written stuff. I know she's obviously directed other stuff coming from TV and things. But I don't know, is she a writer? And I know she's got this personal investment, as has Gal Gadot, with this character now. And fair play, because, again, they made the best DC movie in this universe.
Yep.
To this point. And yeah, see, I'm sounding really negative about this movie now, but I actually do like it. And I just feel there are problems with it. The Invisible Jet one was a big one. It was like he got one switch wrong in his defense. but only one switch, and then you figured out how to fly a jet coming from flying a World War One plane. I know he's supposed to be an ace pilot, and I guess it's supposed to demonstrate that, but I know at least have put him on some sort of flight simulator game in the arcade or something first. When she first started doing her invisible powers, I was like, no, don't give her superpowers like that. Mm-hmm. But then the point of the power, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll take it. And as you said, it's the only way to make sense of an invisible jet if you have to have an invisible jet. And I appreciated that.
If you're going to make the nod, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I liked what you said about the lasso. I think we're in agreement on that because that's just weird how that works.
Even its powers are undefined now.
Yeah. What does it do? It actually looked kind of odd. I thought it looked much better in the first movie. You know, it's the lasso. It's the flying. You know, when Steve's, again, I keep coming back to the fact that this, none of it's surprising when he's talking about, you know, flying is easy. It's just this and this. And immediately my brain goes, she's flying by the end of this movie. She's going to fly.
Totally. And I don't mind that she flies because off and on in the comics she has that power.
Yeah, completely. No issue with that. Yeah, it's just that there are ways that you can do these things, I guess. I mean, I'm not a screenwriter, but there must be a way that you can do that kind of thing without putting a big flashing sign on it.
Without telegraphing it, yeah.
Without telegraphing it, yeah. Yeah, and catching lightning with a lasso or whatever we do.
Yeah, see, like, yeah, that it's supposed to be a lasso of truth, and that's it. Like, in the first movie, she was a sword and shield warrior. That's what she was supposed to be. And in this, she's just forgotten about that. So, I mean, yes, she's lived for, I don't know, maths, 100 years?
How long has she lived? When was she?
Well, if she's in World War One, what's that, like over 100 years, right? And so, oh, no, because it's 84.
She's an adult. And yeah, I mean, you know, we don't know how old she 70. Is.
Overall. Well, yeah, I know, but I mean, just on Earth. She's, you know, in our world, say 70 years, right?
Sure, yeah.
And so, yeah, okay, so she probably doesn't have as much call for a sword and shield as the decades roll on. But even in Batman versus Superman, which is set after Wonder Woman 84, she's sword and shield Wonder Woman. And that's the Wonder Woman we like because she's the Amazonian warrior.
Yes.
It's what she's supposed to be. And it was a good depiction. Now she's eschewed all that and she's going full lasso. But the lasso, it's supposed to be the lasso of truth, right? But now it's the lasso of everything. Because the reason I hate their ending with Maxwell Lord is I don't get it. She wrapped him in the lasso.
Why does it
and started talking. Mm-hmm. She's not. It's not a tin cup on a string. Like,
that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I like that.
That's how it came across to me. I was like, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It was
if
weak.
You're not careful, if you're not careful, it's a utility belt.
Yeah, well, that's
and if you're really not careful, it's a utility belt with shark repellent spray.
Yeah.
And that's a leap, right? I'm aware. Nice. But if you're not careful, if you go, well, we've got a plot point, how do we write ourselves out of this? Oh, the lasso does it.
Yeah, and that's what it was. Now. Yeah, it can.
You know, I mean, the tiara that pings off things, that's a nod to the comics. That's always done that. I like that.
Yeah, kind of and thing. That was cool too, and it looked good too.
It's a cool thing to do, right?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's a get out of jail.
It was in this movie.
If you do it wrong. And I think they did it wrong.
But in saying that, I had heaps of fun for the first half of the movie, especially. I liked the mall scene, regardless of weird lasso stuff and weird physics, and just weird looking CGI. Like in this day and age, it's just inexcusable.
I'm going to throw you a question around that. Sorry, just to interrupt you. If she's kind of she's in hiding, right? You know, she's not out in the world.
Yes.
To be obvious, because you know we've established in Superman versus Batman and that Superman Batman movie that she's still kind of hiding that she's Wonder Woman. When she's out in the mall, why does she change into the costume? Why does it matter?
When she's out of the mall.
When she's in the mall and she's fighting and she's taking those guys down.
Oh, yeah.
If she's kind of been hiding, if she's got the lasso with her anyway, maybe she's got the tiara, she can just wear that, she can have it with her. I'm being really picky now. But why does she have to be in the costume?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's obviously just for us as the viewer.
Because it's a visual thing, but it's just stuff that I think about that says, well, why is that then? If you're in hiding, why are you in the armor?
Yeah, but you're not going to have a whole movie with her not in the armor.
No, you're not. And so from a movie point of course, that's what you do is you dress her in that.
Yeah, but I see your point.
Yeah, I'm kind of, I'm in hiding, and then I'm going to spend a lot of time in an earlier movie hunting down this photo that proves that I was around in the First World War.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah. Even something that explains why she's Diana Prince, and if she's been Diana Prince for presumably 70-odd years at that point, you know, maybe she has a lot of jobs. Maybe she moves around. She clearly needs something where she's out in the world and she makes money and she can live. You know, I don't think it would have taken much from a couple of lines of dialogue or something to work that one through.
We've been really down on this movie. I understand your point of view, but I'm the one who came in saying I liked it. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I forgave a lot just because I just wanted a Wonder Woman movie. I like the fact that her costume was updated and it was more bright and closer to the colors it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. As I said, I loved her in the role. I liked seeing the depowered Wonder Woman a little bit. I especially liked her versus Barbara in the White House.
It's a good scrap in the White House, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool, and it's nicely choreographed.
It's really easy to get into, but anyway.
Yeah, well, yeah. And, you know, there was some good set pieces. There wasn't enough Wonder Woman in the movie at all. Mm-hmm. It was mostly Diana Prince. The action set pieces that they did do were fun, whether they made sense or not. Yeah, just that third act let it down quite a lot for me. I don't know, like, you can't really have a Maxwell Lord character again. You can't have Cheetah, at least as she is in this movie again. Where do you go for a third movie? The obvious thing would be you're going to bring Linda Carter in as Hysteria, but she's not going to be a villain, surely.
I didn't get that either. I never got the sense from that. You and I talked about this earlier, prior to this, and you thought that was a setup for a sequel, and I never took that as a setup for a sequel. I just thought it was a nod that says, oh, by the way, this is what happened to Hysteria.
No way.
She's done. And I never saw it as a sequel. I haven't seen any other nods around that, to be honest with you. If they want to go down that road, that would be a thing. But again, not as a villain, because why would you?
But why would you bring her into the modern world just to show her, like, why? Not have her meet up with Diana Prince?
I think it's purely just because they kind of mentioned the fact that, you know, I went looking and all I found was the armor. It was just the case to say what happened to her. Yeah, I just figured it was just one of the, it's a Stan Lee.
I feel like there would be certain fans that would be let down if she doesn't pop up in the next movie, though.
Yeah, I think that's kind of for the very hardcore and fair play, that's how you take it. I see where you're going with it, but I never got the impression that that's what they were doing with it. I just thought it was, one, we've got to do a mid-credits because everybody does them now. Thanks, Marvel.
Yeah.
And two, we need to throw a Linda Carter cameo in there. And we did that too, and that was all I took it as.
I feel like if this was a Marvel movie, the end credits scene would have been something to do with the cup she lost that she made invisible.
And
Made a joke out of that. That would have been the mid-credits. Then you would have had an end-credit scene to tie to the next movie.
And then it would have been to something else, the next movie, which, again, possibly just points to the fact that, again, I still get the impression that DC doesn't have a Marvel plan.
No, and I don't think they're even going to go that route anymore. I think they've even said that. It didn't work.
Mm, yeah.
And everything will be standalone, and that's why you don't have very much mention of anyone else in this movie.
Yeah, that's why we're not getting Wayne Enterprises logos or copies of the Daily Planet.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, would have been fine because Daily Planet, no doubt would have been around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's decades old paper.
I don't know where you go with the third movie. I don't know who you have as the protagonist.
No, I've been racking my brain trying to think of where you go, who's the big bad out of it. And, you know, unless you go back to the whole, the Olympus mythology and things like that, which is something that they genuinely could have done. There's a lot of great stuff you can mine from that. You know, Perry's stuff and Lin Wein and Phil Jimenez. You start to look at things that Greg Rucka wrote and Gail Simon's run and all of that. Maybe there's some things in there that you could do, but I don't know. Nothing stands out to me as what's the next big bad?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who's your brainiac?
Maybe it'll spin out of the Snyder Cut, which is
maybe
the next time we'll see her. But yeah, anyway, that's all speculation, and
we won't know until they make it.
Yep, and I will proudly die on the hill saying that this movie is not as bad as everyone says, even though it sounds like I just said it was.
Look, and good on you. You know, look, we've learned to agree to disagree over time, you and I. And again, I've defended my corner enough in terms of things that I like and don't like. I never give you grief for liking what you like. That's the whole point of this, is that you find stuff that works for you. You know, you watch The Queen's Gambit and you love it. People will watch The Queen's Gambit and won't love it. There'll be people who watch Blade Runner 2049 and think I'm an idiot. I go, what the hell was that?
Mm.
You know, we all are what we are.
One big happy geek family.
Well, I don't know about the happy. We're one big geek family, though. I'll call it that.
Happy. We just have that odd cousin or uncle that you disagree with every now and then.
Yeah, I think that's me.
Yeah. But anyway, overall, I liked it. I will definitely watch a third one, but again, I'm slightly biased. It is what it is. Not as good as the first one, but still not as bad as I think everybody is making it out to be.
I'm happily prepared for you to attempt to talk me into watching a third one, and I will listen to you when you do it.
I don't think I can at this point. You made a better argument against this movie than I did for it, so I think we know where we stand on that one.
I'm always better at articulating stuff I don't like or why than articulating stuff that I do, so, you know.
Yeah, but I went into this trying to defend the movie, and I ended up just talking about the stuff that I didn't like. So, man, I promise I liked it. Not that anyone cares.
I know you did, and that's okay.
I will watch it again. Let me just say that.
Good man. I will not.
Figured. Yeah, good. All right.
And now for something completely different.
Welcome to the first edition of a new segment on the show that we like to call Clayton's Corner, where we have our friend and co-host from our other show, the Heritage Film Club podcast, come in. We'll give him some homework to go away and read or watch something that has impacted pop culture in some way, and as a non-geek, come and tell us what he thought. So, welcome, Clayton, to The Rambling Geek.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm a little scared.
A little scared.
Yeah, well, you guys, the rundown of this was that you guys were just going to give me something, I go away and look at it, and come back and express my views. So, yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
I don't know why you're nervous, because you're so shy.
No, not because I'm shy, because I have no idea what you're giving me.
you know what you've come here to talk about today.
I do, but I don't know what my next assignment is either.
Oh yeah, but we'll give you that at some point. So the plan will be to just add the segment in every few episodes and give you time to go away and read something or watch something and gather your thoughts and come back and share.
Happy to.
All right, cool. So for this one, we asked you to read a seminal entry into the Batman canon, an entry into the specifically Dark Knight Returns universe, written by legendary comic writer and artist Frank Miller and drawn by legendary artist Dave Mazzucchelli. We asked you to read Batman Year One. So, what did you think?
Interesting. I didn't feel that, I guess that it was going to be basically this is Batman's first year as being Batman. But after reading it, it didn't actually feel like a Batman comic. It felt more like Jim Gordon's story. Jim Gordon, yeah? That's the cop dude, yeah. It felt more like his story because it didn't really have a lot of Batman in it. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Okay, so I read it as well. And yeah, I agree. The first two issues certainly are very heavy with Jim Gordon's story. But yeah, you're right. It's more a Jim Gordon in Gotham City Year One.
Was it supposed to be like a Batman Year One like story, or have I completely missed the mark on that one in the sense that there wasn't a lot of Batman in it?
Yeah, it is. It is kind of that. It's one of the first instances, if not the first one, I think, where it kind of recognizes that he didn't just drop into Gotham and he was Batman and boom, he was away.
Okay.
You know, he'd been somewhere and he'd been off in training and then came back, and then it was the idea that, you know, he goes out into the street in a disguise that no one's really buying. And kind of gets the crap beaten out of him a little bit and figures out that he needs to do something different. And so it's kind of that Batman right from the start.
Okay. You know,
I think Year One's just a really good label, and then it becomes something that DC used all the time and everybody got a Year One. Yeah, it was that, you know, comes in, builds those relationships, he gets a relationship with Gordon, all that kind of stuff. And it's just meant to be that. It's just a jumping on point, a starting off point really for Batman and changing the game on a whole bunch of characters.
So I got the deluxe edition, and it had an introduction, and it sort of gave you a little spiel about why it was being created. Was there not a Batman Year, like a Batman Year One comic prior to this?
No, it had never really been done. That whole thing of you know, where does it start off? It's just like you're off and running, and it was kind of they'd done it after Crisis on Infinite Earths and done a bit of a reset, and it was a complete change, even the way that it looked and the color and all that kind of thing. It was just completely different to anything that had ever been done, and it was Frank Miller coming in and going, you know, I did the end with Dark Knight, I'm going to do the beginning, and it kind of kicked off a whole bunch of new stuff.
Oh, good.
And it really hadn't been done in that kind of way before, and it was probably one of the first really super serious Batman comics. Really, and like Mike said, it's a seminal moment. It really changed the game.
So this is iconic in relation to Batman comics per se, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. No,
it was new.
It was interesting because it held my attention because I powered through it. I didn't get bored. There was a few things I was like, oh, say what about in this? Like, did they have a working relationship with Disney at this time? Because Mickey Mouse came up in this book twice.
So did Donald Duck and Peanuts, Charlie Brown in the gang.
And I was like, what? That's not Marvel.
No, it did explain that at the end, in issue 4, when Catwoman robs Commissioner Loeb's house and gets all his pop culture collection, which is worth
$40,000. And they're ripping it apart.
Made me cry a little bit.
Things you shouldn't do, even in a comic book.
How they got away with using those characters so blatantly, not sure. But no, DC and Disney are not a thing, certainly not now. With Marvel,
but not back then either. No, there was no working relationship.
Yeah.
I like the fact that it had Catwoman in it, eh?
Yeah, it was sort of her intro as well.
Yeah, completely reworked origin too. And it was really controversial at the time. And I remember when I first read it, I didn't like it. I'm still not sure I like it. I'm a little more traditional with my Catwoman, I have to say.
This was interesting for me because I always thought Catwoman was just a jewel thief. But like talking to you guys, you've said that, you know, she had a bit of a more shady past prior to that. Where this book actually sort of, you know, showed me the fact that she was like, not so much. She did a lot of stuff at night, put it that way.
Yeah, that's pretty much, this is pretty much where that comes. That's a really diplomatic way of putting it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know if I could say the extra. So this is the first instance where I've seen her as a prostitute, put that way. Well, not as a prostitute, but in the realm of where you first meet her because Batman's having a go with the girl's pimp, and then she jumps down, and you're like, oh, okay, so this is her world. It's not just the jewel thief that I actually already knew of.
No, she wasn't even a jewel thief at that point. Yeah. She was just a prostitute, and she decides to change her career, and I think it's issue 1 or 2.
Yeah, which was cool for me because I never had read that or known that prior besides you guys telling me that. So,
yeah, I think even then, from memory, I think that there's been a little bit of conjecture, I suppose, as to exactly what she's doing in year one.
You don't think she's a prostitute?
Well, there is a school of thought that says no. That not explicitly said, because they don't really come out and say it, and that's the bit where she's got the guy, he's kind of tied to the bed, and she's, you know, hit me again, Selina, kind of thing. And to the point of, is that as far as it goes? And whether that's a retcon for people like me trying to make themselves feel better, I don't know. But
so you'd feel better if she's a dominatrix?
No, not at all. No, I don't think it makes any difference. But there's people who debated it over time to go, well, because he doesn't really say it. You know, what is she really doing? And then, yeah.
Plus she has a kid hanging around all the time.
Yeah, she's got Holly.
That's not her kid, though, eh?
Precisely.
Yeah. They're just like pals. No. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, so Holly is an underage street worker.
Yeah, Holly very much is. That's never ambiguous.
I was going to say, did any of you like go through the stages with Jim Gordon in this book where you sort of liked him and then he was an arsehole and then you sort of came back and liked him at the very end?
Yeah.
That middle part, man, just where like he's got the baby and he's having domestics with his wifey, but then he's cheating on his wifey with the cop.
Oh, before his baby's born, his wife is
and
pregnant.
Then he gets caught, and then he has to tell her, which is cool. But out of all that, the cop is the only one who actually knows that Bruce Wayne's Batman, and then they ship her off. And I'm like, oh, man, if they actually kept her in the squad there, they would have already known who Batman was.
The way I read the end where Bruce Wayne saves James Jr.,
mm-hmm.
I think, in the river after he gets thrown off the bridge, and Jim Gordon has obviously fallen off the bridge as well. And he gets up without his glasses and he says, oh, you know, my eyesight's not very good when I haven't got my glasses. I read that as I clearly can see who you are.
I said I.
Oh, yeah, good.
Me not so much. I know where you're going with that, but I didn't read it that way at the time and I still don't, just because it was the way it was done then. It was always, they used to always tease that Gordon knew or that Lois knew. And they would never say it, though. You would just do it. It would be a thing. You know, and it's kind of, that's obviously what Frank Miller's looking to do. It's going, well, of course, I figured it out. How stupid do you think I am?
Plus, he's supposed to be Super Cop.
Well, exactly.
The other chick was Super Cop.
Yeah, Essen, I think her name is, right?
Essen.
Was she in Essen, yeah. Long Halloween or one of those Loeb books? I feel like I've...
She comes back later because he marries her later. Hmm? Yeah, she comes back in the 90s. It comes back in the 90s when Gordon and his wife, they're divorced, yeah. And
what?
Comes back, and then, yeah, and then he marries her.
No way.
Yeah, then Joker kills her.
Yeah, Joker's not being kind to Gordon's family. I've got a question, because as much as I'm a big fan of Batman, I know the major points. I don't know all of the little extra bits. So in this book, Lieutenant Gordon, has a son. And obviously we all know that he has a daughter who grows up to be Batgirl. What happened to the son? Was he retconned out?
No, he comes back later in...
As a superhero?
Oh, no, not at all. Very, very bad man. And I'm probably going to get this wrong, and people can flame me all over this podcast if they want to. It's one of the first things that Scott Snyder wrote
before
New 52. And is it Black Mirror or something like that, I think? Yeah, and he comes back, basically. And to get revenge on the family, basically, yeah. Because even around that time, it's like the time of year one, there's the whole thing of Barbara's his niece, not his daughter. And then that changes, and it changes again. They fiddled around with it all over the place, and there's bits where she was the daughter all the way through. Batgirl was the daughter.
Oh.
And then there was a point at which they went, no, that won't work. We'll make her his niece, and he looks after her. And then they should have changed their minds again. But, yeah, James Jr. comes back later.
So how did they explain his absence? He just went off with his mum when they divorced? Or?
Yeah, I think that's what it was, yeah, from memory. It's been a while since I read it. Like I said, I couldn't even remember exactly the name of the story. But
he didn't cheat again, did he?
Not so far as I'm aware.
Okay, so they just divorced because they got sick of each other.
Yeah, I think it was just a thing. Okay. Plus, you know, you're a cop living in Gotham City. How easy is that?
So what was your thought process on Gordon, since it is really a Gordon story? And people can argue that if they want, but that's clearly at least two of our point of views. How did you like the character, Clayton?
I liked the story and the character. Yeah, good. It took me on a roller coaster solely because I had that middle part where I really, really disliked him. And it was where after he got beat up, I felt sorry for him. But then he came back and beat up Flash?
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, sweet, you're badass now. Then he cheated on his missus. And I'm like, oh, I wish now they would actually come back and beat you up because you've been an idiot.
No, say what you told me.
Oh, he's been a But then when they leave Bruce Wayne's manor and... Mm-hmm. Bruce Wayne's like, they've been sitting out there for like 10 minutes. And then I'm guessing that that's when that conversation was taking place, because the next panel or thereafter was her going, yes, I already know that they had an affair, whatever, when she's on the telephone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was him talking to her on the phone.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He had to do it before he was blackmailed.
You know that not Flash, but the next guy up?
Commissioner Loeb.
Yeah. Is he like... Does he turn evil to a really evil mastermind person, or he's just dodgy?
He's already crooked in this.
Oh, no, but does he ever get more crooked or no? Like Joker or Penguin level or no?
No, I think he's like a corrupt cop.
Ah, but okay.
Brian might be able to correct
him. Yeah, basically, yeah.
Because he's in the Long Halloween, right?
He is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of they go back to a lot of stuff that was sort of introduced in this, and because things like Long Halloween are a lot more down to earth.
Hmm.
You know, it's a little bit more, I don't know. Realistic. I know it's a weird thing to say for a Batman comic, but it's a more realistic version as opposed to, you know, gadgets and freaky villains and all that kind of stuff. That was kind of the point.
After reading that first episode of the first book of four, it gave me the sense that Gotham is really, really, really seedy. So I'm guessing that's the way it was supposed to be portrayed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Very much so. Yeah, that's the whole corrupt police department and, you know, corrupt commissioner and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was really explicit from here. And then lots of other places like the movies, everything have picked up from that as well, of course.
Okay, that's cool.
Frank Miller became famous for working on Daredevil for Marvel. That's where he became big. And his Gotham feels very similar to his Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
It's more of a real place, like Brian said. Even I was thinking this when I was reading year one, is when the very start of issue one, Gordon's coming into Gotham for the first time by train.
Yeah.
And it's a very realistic city. in a train, and it's very much just like, you know, certain parts of New York or something, or
yeah,
or wherever it's supposed to be. Mm. And I couldn't marry the ideas of that city housing people like Bane, the Joker, Riddler, Mr. Freeze, and all of these. They introduce Catwoman in a way that makes it seem like it fits.
Yeah.
But I'd be interested to see how he would have been able to introduce the more fantastical characters and still keep it grounded.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Well, yeah, I think it's a fair point. You know, there's like the bit at the end with the Joker card.
I was going to bring that up too.
You know, and you kind of recognize that backwards if you started with didn't start with the comics, you know what I mean? And that even then, that's still a Joker who, you know, fell in the vat in the original version, you know, and he's a criminal, he's a psychopath and lunatic, you know, that's not superpowered, there's none of, you know, there's no Mr. Freeze in that. That's kind of the whole point of it, you know, it is that it's a Daredevil New York, you know, with Mazzucchelli or Mazzucchelli, however you want to say it, however you pronounce it, you know, that's why the art marries with that. I think if you put anybody else on that, it wouldn't have had the same kind of tone. And the colors are all very different. It's street level. It's down and dirty.
Now, the deluxe edition I got was four comics. Yeah, mm-hmm. Does it lead into like a greater? I don't know. Like, is there like another paperback to it, or like, does it lead anywhere or else? Or no?
No, it was pretty much just
standalone.
It was standalone. Yeah, okay. It was never a thing that Frank Miller's going to do this. You know, he's the regular writer now. It was just come and do the story. And off he went and just left that there for other people to play with. And they did like a year two, which is very different in tone. It looks different. It's not the same thing. They kind of...
not related to this at all?
No, not at all. Okay. It was just, here's some new stuff to play with. Here you go.
I was going to talk about that the last couple of panels, or the last page anyway, of book four. Probably my favorite ending of a comic ever. And it's what you said, where he starts talking about the Joker and he says... there's real panic on. Somebody's threatened to poison the Gotham Reservoir. Calls himself the Joker. I've got a friend coming who might be able to help. She'll be here any minute. Mm-hmm. That is fantastic. And I remember when Batman Begins first came out and you and I, Brian, went and saw that at the movies.
Yeah.
And that's how that movie ends. And I marked out hard.
it's an all but ideal way to end anything if you're going to set up at the end of a Batman story and go, oh, yeah, check this guy out.
Yeah.
Joker.
Unlike the book where they didn't have to follow up on it or pay it off because we already know who the Joker is outside of this book.
Exactly.
That movie really sort of painted itself into the corner of having to have the Joker now, which turned out good. The movie is not my favorite of the trilogy, but there's no denying Heath Ledger is a presence as the Joker. Cool. So Clayton, I was going to ask you, so the bits of Batman that were in it, what do you think? Because like he's not... Super Batman. He's not, you know, he doesn't have an answer to everything tactically. He doesn't have all his gadgets, like Brian said.
I wanted more. Like, after finishing it, I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, I came away going, okay, this must be a Jim story. That's cool. I get why Batman was in it. And then I was like, so where's the actual Batman U1 story? Like he returns and he's now becoming Batman. That's what I want to read.
It's like every other comic for the 70-odd years before that. No, I actually ran
50. Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, okay. It's kind of, the whole point of it, I think, is kind of that you get to the end of it and he's kind of established as Batman and he's frightening the mob guys and, you know, Catwoman's on the board and all that kind of stuff. Okay. I think that's pretty much it. Take your point, though. You know, if you're looking at it, it is much more of a Gordon story than it is a Batman story. You know, point being, they're all kind of in place as you know them by the end of it, and you go, oh, okay, that's how we got here.
Yeah.
Next month, Two-Face.
But it does solidify that Gordon-Batman relationship.
Yeah, it was good to read on that basis to see how they intertwined to start with.
Yeah.
That was quite cool.
And did you like I think I'm going to have to take a guess, and it was only four. It was either two or three. I think it was two. That was very Batman heavy. Where he goes into the old abandoned building when he's on the run, Batman, and he has to evade a platoon of riot cops.
And a helicopter supposedly nuking them or whatever the hell that was.
Yeah. did you like the fact that really showed an unprepared Batman?
Yeah, it was cool because it's like, okay, like, you want to be like, oh, you go do your tricks, Batman, like I was. But then I was like, oh, I'm reading it. Oh, he hasn't got everything that he's got, let's say, in the movies or what I see at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite cool. And that's what, and I think that's what left me wanting more, because it's like, okay, he was able to escape that part. Cool, he escaped and he got the suit and paid for it, but I didn't see how exactly he got went in, got the suit and left. Like, what actually happened? You know, what fill in the little bits for me. But that was cool.
Oh, yeah. This is a problem with you with everything. You need everything shown very specifically. You can't just take the, hey, that's a cool thing, he ran in to get a suit.
Cool, but I'm like, I don't need it, but that left me wanting more. Like, okay, I really want to read, like, a Batman year one comic with like the first year of him becoming a crime fighter.
Yeah, it's almost a mistitled comic in that sense. Yeah.
What it did kick off was a lot of stuff that happened. And so they kind of really picked up the concept and ran with it. And he ended up with a lot of stories that told the thing of who trained him, where did he go? You know, like the stuff at the beginning of Batman Begins where he climbs the mountain and he goes and finds the League of Shadows.
Yeah.
And someone who trains him to be the kind of the ninja skills, if you like. And so they did a whole bunch of stuff that followed after that. You get like one-off stories and things and multi-part stuff, which was who trained Batman.
And
it really kicked it off. And it kind of goes backwards. It's almost before year one, if you like. You know, where's he been for 15 years or whatever, being not Bruce Wayne?
In the comic, and because you first see him flying back as Gordon's training in, I just assumed he was with the League of Shadows. And just coming back.
But that's because you've seen Batman Begins.
Yeah. So I was just like, okay, sweet. He's done his training with the League of Shadows. He's called Ra's al Ghul. Sweet. He's coming back to Gotham. Yay. Welcome back.
Oh, look at you. We introduced you as a non-geek and you rattle off Ra's al Ghul's name.
No, because it's from the first Batman movie. The one where he's like, I am Batman and I talk like this the whole three movies. I don't move my voice at all.
His voice gets way worse than the second and third one. All right. So overall...
Yeah.
You liked...
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good. It held my attention. I would say if you want to read something, go read it.
Okay. It's just if you want to read anything.
No. But I mean, like it's a four part comic. And as you said, it's a standalone one. Mm-hmm. For me, because I'm not as geeky as you guys, I like the fact that it's just, it's standalone. I don't have to read 20 other trade paperbacks to get the full story. It's just like, as is. So it's like, sweet.
And then you can go off and kind of read Dark Knight, which is the end, you know, supposed to be the end of Batman, and, you know, whether or not that's canon, as they call it. And you could say, well, I've read the beginning, I've read the end. If you want to say that they're the start and finish of the same story, that's cool. Dark Knight, it's Dark Knight Returns. You know, it's like Batman at the end of being Batman, and it's...
They made a cartoon movie of that, eh?
They did, yeah. They did a cartoon of year one as well. There's what? One of each. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, so there's a movie you can go and watch now.
Year one. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Dark Knight Returns, which in fact they did in two movies.
I've seen those two movies. They're really, really good. I really enjoyed them. That's where they end up on horses, at the end.
Yes.
We are the League of Batman or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The mutants.
It's the mutants and the Sons of Batman and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, the good mutant fight in the mud.
In the mud. Really cool. Yeah. Very cool comic book scene as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So you can draw a line between them if you want or not. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a very famous comic.
Oh,
he did that before he did this.
Oh, okay. Cool.
From what you say, Clayton, I think that's probably closer to the Batman you were expecting. Really keen to get your take on that as a comic book.
That's super Batman heavy, their book. That's
I've only seen the movie, so
yeah, well if you've seen the movie, there's probably not many surprises in the book, but maybe we can visit their book. Oh, and another
there's some layers. Yeah, your next mission, should you choose to accept it.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, will I find out my next mission today, or do I have to wait?
No, I think we're going to think about it.
Okay.
And we'll let you know with plenty of time before you come back.
Okay.
But do you have any closing thoughts on Batman Year One before we let you go?
No, it's a good book. Go read it if you want to, and, you know, show love to Batman. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for coming on for the first Clayton's Corner.
Oh, thank you.
We look forward to having you back.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
Mm. Well, that was a good ramble.
It was.
And I think we've gone on far too long, so we'll tie it up there maybe. Did you want to say anything else?
No, I think I can't think of anything else that I really wanted to add. Looking forward to having a look at The Queen's Gambit. Come back next time and see what we've been on.
Good, and I'm going to try and watch Blade Runner maybe. So
nice.
That's a thing. Cool. All right. So thank you for joining us once again as we really rambled this time. But thanks for all the support on social media. If you are not following us, you can do so on Instagram and Facebook at TRG Podcast, on Twitter at The Rambling Geek. If you have friends who like this sort of stuff, then it would be great if you could recommend our podcast, help us grow our listenership. We, of course, thank you for tuning in again and listening to us. So we will be back in 2 weeks with another episode. In the meantime, if you are after something else to listen to, there are about 15 episodes of the Heritage Film Club podcast, which is available also wherever you get your podcasts. And Brian and I co-host that with Clayton from Clayton's Corner. And Brian's nephew, Jared, is on most of them as well. They're fun listens as we discuss movies we are forced to watch by other members of the group. So until next time, we are out.
Loved what you've heard on this week's episode? Well, the answer is simple. It would mean the world to us if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and feedback. Spreading the word really is the best way to grow our podcast and achieve even greater things. Thank you.
That's the end. Thanks for listening.